When I go to a world-class museum like MoMA in New York City, or the Louvre in Paris, I, like so many visitors, go straight to the most popular paintings. At MoMA, there's always a crowd surrounding Van Gogh's Starry, Starry Night. At the Louvre in Paris, there is a roped-off section where you need to buy special tickets to get up close to the Mona Lisa. I have seen both paintings, and yes, they are special. But for the most part, I have found myself quickly bored at art museums. This is not something that I am proud of because obviously there is a reason for museums. There's masters in these museums, masters from times long ago, people that I probably should know. But why? So to kind of get myself into the museum and make it a little bit more entertaining, I started off on this task when I first started Cider Chat in finding Palms in Art. At that time, it was just about seeing if we could find a painting that had an apple in it, or a pear, or more often than not, a quince. And typically, these paintings were still lifes in art, where they would use palms. But today, we're going to go on a little bit of a journey on this edition of Cider Chat, featuring Palms in Art. And I think, like me, you will learn that a lesson from the past can often be used to decipher our life today. Welcome to Cider Chat. This is episode 217. My name is Aria Windcaller, and I am both the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. Now, this particular episode is going live on April 1st, 2020. And if you are listening to this episode within this realm of time in the spring of 2020, you know that the world is a little bit upside down. So we're hanging tight with Ciderville, and we're going to be featuring a very special edition on the topic of art and cider. Looking for similarities and also reaching for lessons from history that can inform us about today and perhaps the future. Looking at art is like tasting cider. They can both be magnificent, perfectly mastered, exceptionally blended, but they can also be boring and one-dimensional. We're going to first look at Michelangelo's sculpture of David. It took him 4 years to chisel away one solid piece of marble. His work began in the year 1501 and was finished in 1504. David, by the way, stands at 517 centimeters high and is 199 centimeters wide, which is 17 feet high and 6.5 feet wide. I mean, just imagine the size of that white marble before the task of sculpting even began. They had to put up staging around that mass, and then one simple misstep, and years of work could be gone. 4 years of work, not to mention all the work it took to get the marble out of there. I mean, it's kind of like all the work that you go to pick up all those palms, the apples, the pears, the quince, all that hard labor, you bring it in, and then sometimes one simple misstep, a leaking airlock, an airlock you didn't fill, or the barrel was just like letting in oxygen, or there was something that was just not quite sterile enough, and something happened. Yeah, we've all been there, right? One simple misstep, and the whole world can turn upside down. Michelangelo's David is, by the way, a really cool sculpture to view. But you should know that you have to typically wait in line to get into the museum, which is based in Florence, Italy. And then once you're in, you are standing around David with typically a lot of people viewing also. Now, I do want you to know, I'm not trying to deter you if you're thinking, oh my God, all my whole life I wanted to go see David. I want to see Michelangelo's David. And now Rhea's saying, eh, it's not worth it. That's not true at all. It is magnificent and absolutely worth your time. For me, I went in February and the crowds, there was no problem. We were able to walk right in and there was just a few people around that magnificent sculpture. But despite all that, I found myself ready to leave after about 3 minutes. Yep. 3 minutes and I was ready to go. All that time, I travel all the way across the world, it felt like, and there, my attention span just kind of waned away. I didn't realize at the time that David is an excellent example of art from the Renaissance era. I had no idea at the time what that even meant. But now, thanks to my research for Palms and Art, this period of time I have found is all about symmetry. Yes, symmetry. Oh, the Renaissance was all about depicting the idealized human, the perfect scene. And I know if I knew then what I know now, I would have lingered longer before that marble statue, before bolting for the door. Cider, like art, can overwhelm and turn off would-be drinkers. Like art with its early Renaissance, Renaissance, and late Renaissance, cider also has its periods of time. Put simply, there is early cider, pre-prohibition cider, post-prohibition cider, and the period that we are currently in, which I call omnia, which is Latin for everything. In the omnia era of cider, everything is up for grabs, from traditional cider making to modern. The consumers want variety, and the makers are meeting their patrons' demand. As a cider geek, I have some understanding of cider through the ages and enjoy delving into a glass and looking for the subtleties. For the rest of the drinking world, I can only imagine how quickly they might get bored by a cider, saying, "Where are the bubbles?" or, "I can't taste the apples." I've found when life is not relatable, we move on. Plus, nobody likes to feel like a dope. Like, "I don't get that painting" can be flipped just as easily to, "I don't get this cider." What is relatable is a good story. And both art and cider are, thankfully, gold medal winners in this arena. Take, for instance, this episode 217. When I started out, I thought all I was going to be talking about was the portrait of Rudolf II, who also happened to be the Holy Roman Emperor from 1517 to 1612. The painting, by the way, is by Giuseppe Arcimboldo. He used fruits, meats, fish, vegetables, and assorted objects to create portraits. Edibles and objects were Archibaldo's trademark. He did a series of portraits depicting the four seasons, winter, spring, summer, and autumn, and another series on the four elements of earth, air, fire, and water. But his most famous of all is his portrait of Rudolph II. Archibaldo used a pear for Rudolph's nose and big apples for his cheek. His forehead is the bottom of a gourd, and there's a purple fig sticking out of his ears. By the way, his ears are actually ears of corn. You have to definitely take a look at the photo of Rudolph II's lifelike portrait in the show notes and how it matches up against Archibaldo's rendition. If ever there was an artist that engaged palms in art, it is Giuseppe Archibaldo. Knowing Rudolph II's title, I was a little concerned for Archibaldo. Was the Holy Emperor of Rome amused or angered by this fruity depiction? Evidently, it appears he must have been amused and was quite the connoisseur of the unusual. In fact, it was not unique for Rudolph II to be found gazing at his art collection. The guy evidently could deal with out of the box. You know, I bet he would have liked a cider made with habanero pepper from the Omnia era of cider. Archibaldo's portrait of Rudolph II wasn't just a typical portrait like one would see in the Renaissance period. Archibaldo depicted the Holy Emperor of Rome as Vertumnus, the Roman god of metamorphosis. It was a brilliant move by Archibaldo to portray his patron as a god. Like, who wouldn't want that, right? Vertumnus is of particular interest to us students of all things palm, because he was considered a shapeshifter who at one time took the shape of an old woman in his quest to win over the goddess Pomona. And in case you don't know who Pomona is, she is the Roman goddess of fruit trees, gardens, and orchards, and has a unique status within mythology because, unlike Roman goddesses and gods, she does not have a Greek counterpart. Pomona, by the way, comes from the Latin word pomum, spelled P-O-M-U-M, meaning orchard fruit. The tale of Pomona and Vertumnus is told in the 14th book of Roman poet Ovid's Metamorphoses. There are a total of 15 books, which is all actually one poem, telling the story of over 250 myths. Even by today's standards, where we think the Harry Potter series of 7 books is something, imagine Ovid doing so without a great pen to write with, or a computer for that matter. I mean, like, wow. But back to the story of Vertumnus. He had tried to seduce Pomona a number of times before using his superpowers of shapeshifting. He tried being an apple picker, an harvester, a keeper of the vineyard, a fisherman, and a soldier. Nothing worked. Pomona did not want men in her orchards because she didn't want them to trample the gardens. She just didn't trust them. So each time, she turned away the shape-shifting god. It wasn't until he transformed into an old woman that Pomona allowed him to enter into the garden. Once he was next to Pomona and still in disguise as an old woman, he began to tell tales of unrequited love that ended miserably for the suitor. Pomona, though, was not swayed. That was until Vertumnus finally took off his disguise and showed his true self. Pomona fell for the dude, and they lived happily ever after, tending the gardens together. Which goes to show you that the moral of Ovid's story of Vertumnus and Pomona is that deception will not prevail over one's own true, authentic self. Ah, yes, the lesson, to be your own authentic self. That's what it's all about. And we know that this lesson is as true today as it was back then in AD 8 when Ovid wrote his poem, Metamorphosis. And in case you're wondering how long ago that is, well, I'd say it's over 2,000 years ago. And yes, cider was being made back then too. But now let's, for a moment, look to that period of time during which Archibaldo was painting. It was a couple of years later from when Ovid was writing. It was during that period of time called the Late Renaissance, and it spanned the years 1527 to 1600. Now you might be thinking, oh, that's interesting. What happened on 1527? Well, a lot did, especially for Rome. On May 6, 1527, there was what was to be known in the future as the Sack of Rome. The Sack of Rome really had far-reaching impacts around the world. And I don't want to get into it fully, but I just want to share with you a couple tidbits which I think are kind of interesting. Before the Sack of Rome, there were 5,000 inhabitants. From May to when the invading mercenaries left, I think it was as late as November that same year, there were only 10,000 inhabitants who survived. It was a horrific scene, and it took Rome's decades to recover. The sack had to do a little bit with Charles V, who was the holy emperor of Rome before Rudolf II. I have a link here that you could follow to find out more about the sack. What is true, that things changed big time in the year 1527, not only for Rome, but in the art world too. Where the Renaissance saw uniformity and perfect depictions of the human body, the Late Renaissance, which began the same year of 1527 and became known as the Mannerists, was all about stepping way, way out of the box. One of the more popular paintings of this time during the Mannerist era was called The Madonna with a Long Neck. Yep. That's the actual name of the painting, Madonna with a Long Neck. This time was all about elongation of the figures in the painting. Not only was her neck long, but baby Jesus on her lap had a very long torso too. It's almost like the baby's like ready to like fall off her lap. He was so big and long. That painting was done by the artist known as Le Greco, which means the Greek. His name was actually Francesco Masuolo Parmigiano. He was also called Parma, and the poor guy, he passed at age 37. He painted the Madonna with the long neck in 1534. Some say she had a swan-like neck. He also did a self-portrait, which is in a circle frame, and in that painting, the Greek's hand is out in front, and it's super elongated. In this search of mine to understand Archibaldo's use of palms and such in his portraits, I wondered if the Sack of Rome was so over the top that the people at the time, in order to find normal again, had to go to the abnormal first. Elongated bodies, muscles painted to look as if the person was on steroids. The Mannerist period makes you feel uncomfortable. Or, I should say, it makes me feel uncomfortable. But I don't think I am alone. There is an expected element of chaos. Often, the scene depicted is showing tension right before the shit is about to hit the fan. Because I understand a bit more about their use of shock and awe, I've come to appreciate the Mannerist era. I no longer wonder why a picture with someone's super long fingers are there, or why it would even hang in a renowned museum like the Louvre. In these paintings, we are called to contemplate and think out of the box. Now I look for the nuances of the aberrations that were always there in plain sight. But because I did not understand, I didn't see what the artist was trying to tell me. Certainly, Archibaldo's Vertumnus looks quite different to me now. Like Rudolf II, I am amused and reminded of Pomona. I believe this Omnia era of cider is quite similar to the Mannerist period, where anything goes. Like the Mannerists, we see today a bit of chaos, imbalance, and even shock and awe in ciders during this Omnia era. Archibaldo not only painted palms in his art, he also brought his patron, Rudolf II, on a journey. A journey back to Ovid's poem of Vertumnus and Pomona. Cider, like art, has a story to tell in every glass. It requires the maker to not only produce a product, but to engage with the patrons and to tell the story of the palm. Someday in the future, there will be an Archibaldo of this Omnia era of cider that future generations will speak of and salute years from now. How long will this Omnia era of cider last? As I figure now, it is less than 20 years old, which, if we look to art as our guide, is a relatively short period of time. It takes time for an era like this Omnia time to transform. Transformation is inevitable, and more often than not, it is uncomfortable. This spring of 2020 is one of those moments of time worldwide when transformation is here, whether we like it or not. 2020 will be told in stories and noted by generations to come. And sadly, it will not differ too much from the sack of Rome in its impact. We are living the history of tomorrow. Creating a timeless work of art or a standout cider requires a little bit of letting go and a willingness to transform. It is what separates the masters from the participants, and in turn produces a relatable story that both helps people turn into and also makes them stop and pause. Ah, the wisdom of palms in art. I leave you there. Be safe, be kind, and bottoms up. This is Rio in Color, signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville. Thank you.
Yeehaw!